Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversations for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. What might inspire a Western doctor to investigate the shamanic healing practices direct from the shamans themselves? And what lessons might those shamans have taught him? Well, we'll talk today with David Cumes. He's an MD, a specialist in urological surgery. And he went investigating, indeed, to Tibet, to Africa's Kalahari Desert, to Peru, to the jungles of the Amazon, to learn direct from the shamans, to add to his own understanding of what is the healing process. He's written Inner Passages, Outer Journeys, and his new book, The Spirit of Healing, Venture into the Wilderness to Rediscover the Healing Force. David joins us from Santa Barbara, where he has a private practice. He all, by the way, was a former teacher at Stanford. Welcome, David. Good to talk with you.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So I know that you grew up in South Africa, so there you were with intact indigenous and cultures to learn from right there in your own backyard. Is that what partly inspired you?
I think at some level it did, but quite honestly at that time, South Africa, as you know, was very much apartheid governed, and there was a lot of disrespect for indigenous wisdom and culture. And I guess I did suffer from some of that, especially through my medical school training. But one of the people that worked for the family was a Sangoma, and I know I was particularly intrigued by him, and you know, his wonderful demeanor, his incredible artistic ability, and just the kind of a person he was. So maybe it had an effect when I was very young.
I enjoyed your book very much, and you talk about sneaking into this man's bedroom to take a peek. To see his healing accoutrements and such. So he kept that very quiet at the time.
Well, he did for the same reason, you know, that most of these people, even to this day, the healers there do not really advertise because they recognize that they may not be well respected amongst not only some of their own colleagues, but maybe also amongst, you know, a lot of the white people in South Africa. But what interested me, that this fellow, as you probably know, remember from the book, had a horde of women patients coming to see him, and I thought he was a bit of a Don Juan, and I couldn't understand it because he wasn't very good looking, and that's what prompted me to peek in his room and look for his healing tools.
You say that even today, and the whole attitude towards the indigenous shamanic healers has changed very much, thankfully, about time. But you say that even today there's many among the bushmen of the Kalahari, many non-bushmen who prefer to go to the bushman rather than a Western doctor for their healing,
well,
black and white.
The bushmen for years have been renowned healers, and I think that most African peoples in that part of the world acknowledge the bushmen for their healing ability and for their ability to travel out of body to the spirit world. They really are quite unique in the so-called trance dance that they do. So yeah, it's true that there are many non-bushmen, both black and white, who eventually ended up going to see San Bushman healers for their healing and who have been helped.
You must have witnessed some of those. Let's start with your adventures among the Kalahari San Bushmen.
Well, you know, the thing is, as a physician, it's always difficult to document whether, in fact, the results are reproducible and continue. And I don't have any data to show that, but there is information where you can basically go and see a trance dance. And one of the amazing abilities of the trance dance is the ability of these people to handle fire and not to be burnt by hot coals. And I've certainly seen people putting coals in their mouth and putting their feet in the fire and not being burnt. There's something extraordinary going on here that has to do with, I think, the vibrational energy at the soul level and even at the level of the DNA, so that the DNA is not denaturing with heat. And I think it's the same ability to tap into this so-called kundalini phenomenon, or what the Bushmen called num, that enables them to channel universal healing energy maybe more expertly than some other people who can do the same thing, almost like they're acting as a direct conduit, so to speak.
You have likened this healing force to the various cultures that have used it and documented it in their own language, from the Kundalini, the Tree of Life, other esoteric traditions. This is all stemming from the same source. Could you describe that?
Yeah, you know, if you look back at ancient scriptures, you can see that there's nothing really new about it. And it seems to me that if you look at what the Bushmen are doing, they basically are evoking a Kundalini experience, the so-called primal feminine energy that rests at the base of the spine that the Bushmen called num. And when this energy moves up the spine, it travels all the way to the top of the head, where, according to the yoga texts, the Shakti feminine energy meets with Shiva, the masculine, and one goes into samadhi, or ecstasy, or nirvana. The Bushmen don't, being Bushmen, don't do that. They basically travel out of body into the spirit world to entreat the spirits for the health of their patient. So a lot of people are doing the same thing for different reasons. The Bushmen are doing it for healing and maybe for scouting game. The yogis are doing it to transcend and to experience samadhi. Now the Buddhists are experiencing nirvana, and so on. Are the people that the Kabbalists are trying to get to Keter, the crown, all mainly for the purpose of enlightenment. But I think the thing about Africa and indigenous people is maybe they can't afford the time it takes to become enlightened, so they use the same energy for very practical, hands-on type of things like healing, and as I said, practical things like finding out where the antelope are so they can hunt them the next day.
It seems to me that this is a natural ability that has been given to us as a survival strategy then.
I think so, yeah. And you know, the thing about it is that there's Bushman rock art showing that they could do this 30,000 years ago. So the fact that the yogis have documented it for the last 5,000 or 6,000 years doesn't make it, you know, that old. It's much, much older than that. And I think we have to go back to tribal peoples to appreciate, you know, this tradition, which was always an oral tradition and never written down, except maybe on the cave walls of, you know, of America. Certainly there's evidence to show it happened here as well, and of Africa.
It's exciting to see the various interpretations of the rock art, including the shamanistic. Those are probably the people that put it there.
Yeah, you know, there's a very interesting fellow called David Lewis Williams who came across some information showing that there are three phases of trance that you can study in people who take, you know, psychedelics. And if one looks at the rock art in the light of these phases of trance, one can see very clearly that a lot of the rock art is represented on the walls of the caves in these three different forms, the last form of which is shape-shifting into animal-like forms, half animal, half human-like. And it's at that stage when somebody maybe experiences themselves becoming a lion or an eagle that they can actually transcend and travel out of body, and they get these unique powers which enable them to heal and do other things, including control heat.
And I'm going to talk to you about that controlling heat in just a moment, but it seems like this num, this force, very much directed. You have various intent as you go into it, whether for an experience of nirvana, to shapeshift, to have that experience of becoming an animal, at least in consciousness, as you point out, to heal, to seek information. So it's interesting how it can be, we can direct ourselves within that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a culturally biased thing, and it'll depend on your culture and your belief system as to how it manifests. And in a way, that's what I really appreciate about the Bushman experience and the tribal experience, is they're not trying to dictate to anybody what should happen to them. Like if you read the yoga texts, they will give different colors for each chakra, and they'll give different, you know, animals for each chakra. And I think those are all well and good if you're a Hindu, but, you know, it may not be good if you're a Christian or if you're a Muslim or if you're a, you know, a Zulu. So everything is very much dependent on your conditioning, and you're going to see what you are accustomed to seeing. If I go into a trance state, and I've done ceremonies in the Amazon, you know, with shamans there, I don't see anacondas and jaguars. I see elephants and African type of things because, you know, my roots are African. So I think that can be a problem, is people reading the scriptures and then trying to get that experience that is laid down in the scripture, whereas they may not have that imprint in their mindset.
And the other interesting thing about the San Bushmen is they do it without hallucinogens, you point out.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about, you know, the South African model in general, that's not to say that they have not used hallucinogens to sometimes help apprentices, people who are having difficulty in breaking through. But once they know how to do it, they do not use hallucinogens. So it's purely the rhythm of the dance, the fire, the rattles they put around their legs, the incredible chanting the women do. You cannot isolate the trance experience from the amazing harmonies that and the clapping that you hear in the Kalahari night, and that's incredibly powerful. I mean, if I took you there, you might not trance, but you would definitely be in an altered state of consciousness after 2 or 3 hours of this singing. And it's kind of a recipe for the trance that's, you know, is ancient and pretty wonderful.
Can you describe what the singing, the dancing, is it fast-paced, is it slow, does it change? Give us a sense of it.
It doesn't change very much. The harmonies change a little bit and the singing changes a little bit. Mostly it's not words at all. It's very much like chanting. But the clapping is extraordinary because firstly they clap with the kind of the cups of their hands, so the sounds are quite different to the kind of clapping we would be thinking about. And the clapping, they're using their hands as a musical instrument, so the rhythms are very complex and they're almost totally synchronized. It's almost like you're watching a flight of birds who know when to turn exactly, and you don't know, there's nobody leading it, but the women mm-hmm. seem to know exactly when to change the cadence of the clapping, and there's different harmonies in clapping going on at the same time. And then the men are dancing to a very set, repetitive rhythm around the fire, which is very energetic. It's sort of a hopping kind of a beat, and not that easy to do. And it can go on all night. And, you know, what exactly happens there, I don't know. I just know that there aren't too many people who can do that and get into the altered state that they do. And then what will happen is that eventually one of the bushmen will fall and trance, and they will be out prostrate. Sometimes they fall into the fire, so they do have to be watched. You know, there certainly is. And then trance state comes on, it's quite extraordinary. And when you talk to them about it, they will say, well, they went up into the spirit world. They see the light. They almost call it a near-death experience. They call it the little death. And some of the more powerful healers will talk about encountering the great spirit and other ancestral spirits. But once this had happened, they can get intuitive knowledge as to the status of their little group, who might be sick, why they're sick, and then they will come back and they will heal with sort of hands-on, distributing this universal healing energy through the participants and the people. It's really a very close, intimate phenomenon. Not only that, but some, you know, when one person will trance, then sometimes the others will start to trance. It's almost like a group phenomenon. And some of the more powerful healers are known to be able to induce trance states in some of the less mature dancers, much the way that a yogi guru can...
Darshan, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly, the Shaktipat they do.
Wow. How long are they out when they're out?
Well, the longest I've ever seen was recently I was there, and the one fellow was out for about 10 minutes, and the women were getting extremely worried about him. You know, because their concern is that the spirit is traveling and it might not want to come back, which is the case mm-hmm. of the near-death experience. A lot of the people who've had one will say they didn't really want to come back. It was so wonderful. And this one fellow didn't want to come back, and there was a lot of dancing and chanting around him by some of the dancers. Eventually, one of the women took some coals out of the fire and put it in his mouth.
Ouch.
And that got his attention, I guess. He started to move after that. And you know, up until then, though, they were obviously very concerned that he may have checked out.
So they work fast for those few minutes that they're away in that trance to gather up that information and do all that. They also say it feels like lightning.
Yeah, you know, if you look at the Kabbalistic description of what happens when energy moves up their chakra system or the tree of life, they call it like the lightning bolt. And if you talk to the Bushmen or you look at some of the descriptions, they say it moves like lightning. It's vibrational energy. It actually moves in the spiral because the chakra system, the three main energy channels, the one central channel up the spine, goes up straight, but the other two, the masculine, the feminine, the sun and the moon channels, spiral up and down the spine, very much like the DNA helix. You know, and the yogis say, as is the microcosm, so is the macrocosm. So as is the DNA and the cellular energy, so is the movement up the spine, and so is the cosmic energy. It all moves the same way. So when this energy moves, it moves in a spiral, and it's appreciated sometimes as like a vibration or a zigzag or a lightning bolt if it's exceptionally powerful. And this is a universal description, sometimes to the extent that I've heard a Peruvian shaman say they went up onto the mountain and they got struck by lightning. And I've often wondered if this is literal, you know, and I think in some cases it is literal. They are struck by lightning and something magical happens to them there. But I think it might also be figurative in that the Kundalini experience that they have is like being struck by lightning.
Mm-hmm. And you visited Kridamutwa as well.
Yes, you know, I saw him many years ago when I went with my children and we spent a day with him. And I actually just came back from South Africa and I spent a little bit of time with him. And he's a pretty extraordinary fellow, as you know.
I've heard about him.
Yeah, well, he is what's called a Sanusi. He's really one of the top Zulu healers in Southern Africa. And he's 80 now and he's coming towards the end of his career, and he's just a huge repository of knowledge, and is a seer and goes into trance, and he's a pretty extraordinary fellow. Not only that, but he's a wonderful artist, and he's written a bunch of books, and he's extremely articulate and very, very intelligent. So, I mean, he's a wonderful representative of the tradition.
You talk about how your son was there and he had the thought watching this, oh, this is a load of nonsense, and Credo gave him a telepathic message. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, and I only found this out later, but what had happened is that we were all there in a group. There was actually two families, a friend of mine with her children and me with mine, and he went around to each one of us and gave us, I thought, at least to me, a highly pertinent message as to what was going on in your life. And my one son, who was sitting, I guess, just to the left of him, was thinking in his head, you know, what a bunch of nonsense this fellow is, because he was only 14 at the time. And as he thought that, Kridamutwa looked around at him with his piercing eyes and, you know, almost saying to him telepathically that, I've heard what you thought, and it freaked my son out. Gave him a hell of a fright, and he immediately started to behave himself, intellectually. He wasn't saying anything explicitly, but implicitly he was now on his best behavior.
Also, Credo told you something rather sharp. He said, don't go off to America. You are now a resident and immigre of America. But he said, Africa needs you. Now, Africa needs the attention.
Yes, you know, what saddens him tremendously, and he gave a similar message this time I saw him, is that he says that the people are dying, you know, the AIDS crisis, and the animals are dying, and the traditions are dying. I think he's especially concerned about the fact that traditions are dying, and that many, for instance, like he has nobody to hand on his knowledge to. None of his children are interested in his knowledge. And he said to me, well, what are you doing in America? You should be here. And actually, since that time, I've been spending more and more time in South Africa, and as I mentioned to you a little earlier, I've actually recently become initiated as a Sangoma.
Define Sangoma.
A Sangoma is there are two words for a medicine person in South Africa. One is Sangoma and the other one is Inyanga. Inyanga comes from the word moon. It means a moon person. It's like the initiation is like you go through the process of starting as a new moon, and eventually you blossom into a full moon when you are completely trained as an Inyanga. Sangoma comes from the word Ngoma, which is a drum. And what happens is, unlike the Bushmen who dance and chant and sing, the Africans use drumming to get into a trance state. The state is the same, but because of, again, the cultural differences, they don't travel out of body to the spirit world. Rather, they believe in the ancestral spirits. So when they become what they call possessed by the music of the drum, by the dancing and the drum, then they step aside, the ego steps aside, and then the ancestral spirit comes through and channels through the person, very much like we would experience trance channeling here, those of us that have experienced that. But there it's very dramatic. You can actually see the Sangoma having a full-blown kundalini experience in front of your eyes as they're in that trance. And
how do you see it? How do you know it's a full-blown kundalini? What are the signals?
Well, they just, their whole body is shaking, and they often will shout out, and they get extremely hot. And it fulfills many of the criteria of a kundalini experience in terms of the context, I think, of their, you know, their cultural experience of it. But they shake, they sweat, and they shriek, and it's quite extraordinary to watch. And there's clearly something very dramatic going on physiologically.
Does their voice change? And
the voice will change, and they'll often speak in tongues. You know, somebody who's Zulu might start to speak in Sotho or even in English.
Wow.
And many different ancestors can come through depending on, you know, who is working with them. They don't have to be their own blood relatives. They can be what's called foreign ancestors or Mandawi spirits. So they might be, say, a friend of the family who wants to work through you. Now, the philosophy there is that you're called to heal, and when you're called to heal, usually it comes to your attention as an illness. And what will frequently happen to these people is that they will become sick. They will go to a Western doctor who will not be able to diagnose anything. Everything checks out normal. Then I'll go to a traditional healer, and he'll say, oh, you're possessed until such time as you trained to become a Sangoma or an Inyanga, you will never get better because the ancestors want you to do this work.
Oh, they're forcing your hand here.
Exactly. It's not so much. You know, you do have free will to say no, and they eventually probably will leave you alone, but they'll give you a really hard time. They will try and urge you to complete the work they never completed in their lifetime. So maybe you had a grandmother who was a healer. Now, this grandma says, okay, you know, I think I need to do some work, and they decide they want to come through that person and do healing work. So, in actual fact, when the Sangoma throws the divining bones, the ancestor really throws the bones, and the Sangoma then will read the message. The ancestor is not localized to the space-time continuum, so they are able to see the past, the present, and the future. As we now understanding more and more from quantum physics and from what Larry Darcy has called third era medicine, most of these things are not confined to space and time. So a Bushman can tell you about your past and your present and can tell you about what's going on with your kids in California. He or she is not confined to the space-time continuum. And the same is true with the ancestor. The ancestor is not confined and therefore can give you very useful information that they will either channel directly through you in through speaking in tongues or through the bones or through dreams. And that's really how the paradigm works.
What was your, has your initiation happened yet?
Yeah, no, I've completed the initiation, and I've actually just written a third book that I'm about to find a publisher for. And I'm throwing bones, and I had a bit of trouble with the trance states. I mean, I think I did do a form of trance channeling, but there was nothing as dramatic as, you know, the type of possession that I saw with some of, you know, my black mentors. But, you know, some of the senior mentors I went and consulted about that said, well, you know, you don't expect to have that type of experience because, again, your cultural framework is different. And he says, you're a white person, you're going to be different. So, I know that the bones speak.
How do you read the bones, though? Can you give us some insight? I'm sure some of this has to be kept, you know, secret. I'm sure that was part of your initiation. But what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, the context is pretty simple, really. I think it's very sophisticated and a lot more complete than maybe the I Ching or Tarot or something. There are bones for all polarities. You know, there may be as many as 30 bones in a set. There's bones for health and sickness, for money coming in, money going out, for different ancestors on your mother's side, different ancestors on your father's side, for your spouse, your significant other, for your children, male children, female children, for witches and sorcerers, for your calling, you know, what your spirit and so on. I mean, it just as many bones as you can have. You can allocate anything you want on the bone, as long as you have a sort of an understanding between your ancestral spirit and your mm-hmm. bones.
So you said, here's the language that we're going to use.
Exactly. You know, so this is the language, and when the bones are thrown, then they do not fall random. They fall in a very set pattern. Mm. And then you basically interpret them, and you interpret them as a metaphor, much like you would interpret somebody's dream.
You also say that the certain bone that's very significant will vibrate or light up in the altered state vision of the reader.
You know, that I'm not experienced. I think what I referred to is maybe a shaman in Peru who, this was a shaman who used the San Pedro cactus, which has got mescaline in it. And what he would say was that when he was in this altered state induced by mescaline, because obviously entheogens or plant hallucinogens are the other way to induce the experience, mm-hmm. he would have what he called a mesa, which is used by Peruvian desert shamans, where there's, again, the polarity idea on the left side, or the forces of evil on the mesa, which is like a table, on the right side, or the forces of the light, of good, and he heals in the center, very similar to the bones, but just a different polarity system.
Sure.
And
okay.
What happens is that he would say that when he was in an altered state, he would see a certain article that had been designated vibrating, and he would decide, well, this was the problem, this was where the illness came from, or then on the other side something else would vibrate, and he would say, well, this is the solution to the problem.
Right. Speaking of the Peruvian cultures, which you also went to and investigated, and the ayahuasca, that would be in the Amazon, wouldn't it? It was interesting that you said the songs were so important to that experience. It wasn't just the plants.
Yes.
It was the songs as well.
Yes, definitely. The most overwhelming thing is the combination of the substance, what's called an entheogen, induces a religious experience, and the song. And many of the shamans have these special magical chants that they chant, and depending on how good they are with their chants, so the experience is enhanced. So I did it a couple of times, and the first time the fellow who was the shaman was an amazing, had a wonderful voice and had incredible energy, and he sang right through the night. And the experience was much more powerful than the second time, when the people who were chanting didn't sustain the energy. And as soon as they would stop chanting, you would feel that the actual experience would start to fade.
We're talking with David Cumes. He's a Western doctor who went investigating and learned direct from the shamans of Africa's Kalahari, from Peru, the Amazon jungles, and Tibet. His new book is The Spirit of Healing, Venture into the Wilderness to Rediscover the Healing Force. Coming up, more conversation with David Cumes. I'm Laura Lee. We continue our conversation with Dr. David Cumes. By the way, he has a private practice in Santa Barbara. He's from South Africa, and he's been telling us about his adventures with the Kalahari, the sand bushmen, with other African healers. And now you're telling us a bit about your adventures in the Amazon with the shamans who administer the ayahuasca for very specific healing journeys. I was grateful that you wrote extensively about those in your book, The Spirit of Healing, David.
Yeah, you know, the ayahuasca was a very powerful experience for me, maybe because I'm a very left-brained MD type, and I'm a kind of a hard nut to crack. And I think what the ayahuasca did for me is I needed a big gun to break down my ego. And that's one thing to do austere spiritual practices, and I've certainly practiced yoga and done meditations and fasted and all that stuff, but The one thing that ayahuasca did for me, it's like a very easy way to break the ego down very quickly and get into some of those states that you read about but you've never experienced. And when I did that and I had that experience, I knew that what I read was real, you know. And I certainly would love to be able to trance dance like a Bushman, but I can't. More recently, I have had some experiences with drumming and the Sangoma state, but this was before that. Mm-hmm. And I found it a very valuable experience to, you know, get beyond the ego problem that I have.
The shamans say that you need a strong ego in order to withstand the pulling apart of the ego.
Exactly.
Explain that.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and I think that's part of the problem with, you know, the younger generation, maybe going beyond ego too quickly before they've established the ego and have a solid ground, and that's why I think some of the people will often spin out from the experience. So yeah, I did have a strong ego, and Kabbalah says that too, that, you know, you have to be 40 years of age before you even try any of these Kabbalistic techniques. So I think it's a very good point that you make and that the shamans make. But having a strong ego, it can be a problem once you've got it, and especially when you've established it and you're very rational. So it was good to get beyond it, but, you know, one of the metaphors I like to think of is it's like taking a helicopter to the top of the mountain as opposed to climbing up. The experience of climbing up slowly and in an integrated fashion might be more valid than going to the top, but having gotten to the top of the helicopter, at least you know what the top of the mountain looks like, even though you may appreciate it slightly differently. And you may not have earned it I must say you do earn it with ayahuasca, because it's a highly unpleasant experience, not something you would want to repeat. Apropos our conversation a little earlier, I just have a little bit of a problem exporting the ayahuasca out of the jungle, out of the context of the ecosystem, out of the energy of the place, out of the shamanic ritual and a tradition that goes back, you know, hundreds, probably thousands of years, and trying to adopt it for ourselves. I don't go along with that so well.
I would agree in that the plant is... The point is not just the plant. The point is the songs, the setting, the intent, the respect that it's given, the cultural context. All of that must go into really having the proper experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, not only that, but I think that what happens is probably over hundreds and hundreds of years, the people in the Amazon, their DNA might be primed differently, just like the DNA of a Bushman might be primed differently. The receptivity is different. I think what's happened with us is that being non-primal, non-indigenous people, we are so far from our root self, from our core self, that we don't even know how much we've lost. So, yeah, we are able at times to enter into ceremony and ritual with some powerful shaman who can make us see what we've lost within the context of, now, his milieu. But the problem that I think we both are alluding to is people who then take the substance out of the Amazon and try and be shamans here, that might not work. It's kind of like me taking a Bushman and bringing them to Santa Barbara and having a trance dance here. It's just not the same, you know. It needs the energy of the Kalahari. It needs the whole, gestalt of it. It's much bigger than just... a little thing like that.
And also they say, the shamans I've heard say, that it's the plant spirit that's doing the healing, that's doing the journeying. So it's not just, like in our Western mind, we think chemical substance matter is the key. I think it's much more than that.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. It's like the drum is the access of the Sangoma to the spirit world. There it's the chants and the ayahuasca. It's the same thing. And, the Sangoma will talk with ancestral spirits, and the shaman in the Amazon will channel forest spirits, you know, or the spirit of an anaconda or whatever. It's just, and for us to try and adopt somebody else's culture is a little bit, you know, I'm not saying we can't do it, but I think we have to be a bit wary of, you know, being sure that it's done with the utmost integrity.
Or travel there, help support the culture with tourism.
Exactly.
Seek out the shamans and let them take you on the guided journey.
Exactly, yeah.
Make it a whole big vision quest.
Exactly, yeah.
Get out and go there. wanted to ask you a bit about what you learned from your ayahuasca experience.
Well, I think what I learned was the first time I really did have a near-death experience, as far as I could imagine one. I had a rerun of my life, and I could kind of see myself from the outside looking in, which was quite bizarre, but very useful, because you can certainly get insights that you would never have otherwise about your character, your demeanor, who you actually are, how you look to other people, because now you're looking at yourself as if, you know, maybe your best friend would be looking at you. So I learned a lot about myself going through that experience, and I also learned a lot about aspects of my life that I had a rerun of, seeing what it was that actually came out that highlighted that were, you know, important things that I'd gone through that maybe I trivialized or set aside and so on. You know, the friends in my life that were important, and, you know, the family in my life that mattered and so on. And I think probably more than anything, I think I really got to appreciate that death is not a bad thing, and that, you know, you feel like what it must be like to die, and after that you don't worry about it anymore.
I thought it was very helpful, the distinction that you made in your book about healing as opposed to dying. You know, it's, you can still be healed and yet go on to die.
Yeah. I mean, to be more complete in terms of, you know, your connection with who you are.
Yeah, true healing would take place in terms of being okay with your whole life and your soul being set straight and all of that. It's really independent of whether you live or die.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I try and not misquote it, but there's that one quote, it's a yogi quote, says that death asks not what who you are, but, you know, what you are. Last question is not what have I, but what am I? And I think that's probably what, you know, that whole thing about transcending is all about, is that you get to appreciate there is something else, that there is a sense of belonging, there is something much bigger. It's not just you out there in the middle of, you know, nowhere struggling with, you know, having to make a living and pay the mortgage. If you're prepared to just tap into it, there's a whole field out there that we can communicate with that is actually supportive. You know, it's friendly. It's user-friendly.
And interactive.
And interactive, yeah.
And speaking to us, I think, all the time, if we'll but listen. Interesting what the San say, the San Bushmen say about the nature of illness. Can I quote what you say? How you're quoting them. They say that sickness resides in everyone, but true illness manifests in only a few. What do they mean by that?
I think what they're saying is that we all are always tending towards imbalance, and that health and healing and well-being is really a continual struggle. To balance the polarities. I think if I was to say I've learned, the one thing that I've learned from everything can probably be crystallized in the idea of the balance of polarity of sun and moon, yin and yang, light and dark, and that's really what health and healing is about. So that even the bushmen who are living in this kind of pristine wilderness environment, they're hunter-gatherers, they don't have pollution. They do have stress in terms of, you know, stress, interpersonal stress and hunger stress and survival stress. So they do have stress. But they need to rebalance their group from time to time, so that there are times when, you know, there's sickness within them. They're out of balance. They might be worried about they haven't, you know, hunted efficiently for a while, or the women are having trouble with foraging, or there might be some interpersonal strife. But when they all get together with the trance dance, all of these things dissipate. And, you know, I'm sure you have a spiritual practice. You know, for me, mine is yoga, but it's like I leave work at 5 o'clock and I feel frazzled, and I go and I do 1.5 hours of yoga. I feel like a different person. And unless I do that, I don't know what I felt like before the yoga. I assume that the way I am when I leave my office is normal, when it's really not normal. So that even for the bushmen, you know, they have strife and struggles in their life, and they know that they have to rebalance that stress from time to time in order to create harmony in their interpersonal connections.
You quote one of the bushmen who say that doing this trance, they come back feeling renewed, refreshed, balanced again.
Yes, you know, a lot of those things I was quoting from actually a book called Boiling Energy by Richard Katz. And yeah, you know, he quotes a lot of that type of thing. But there's no question that if you speak to the Bushmen, they will all say that they feel better afterwards. And even the ones that don't trance feel better. And, you know, some of my Sangoma friends say that every now and then they need to get possessed because they feel much better after they get possessed. It's like in order to get into that state where you can actually transcend and travel out of body or get possessed, you have to really balance your energy body very, very finely. You've got to balance those sun and moon channels very exquisitely. And when you do that, you feel great, you know. In a way, the ayahuasca was the same. Because of that, I vomited and I may have felt sick during the ayahuasca experience. Afterwards, I felt exhilarated. There was no hangover or anything else. And I think it's because your energy body is renewed, restored.
We are so out of balance there in these ways, Western culture. And you say that the loss of soul, the loss of self, I guess the disconnect from soul and self is the disease of our time.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is where we're less fortunate than some of the primal peoples who are much closer to that. You know, they can access it much more readily. And you know, for one of us to try and do a trance dance would take a huge effort. Whereas for them, it, you know, just an hour of dancing around the fire and they're there, you know, just it's extraordinary. So we've paid a huge price for our technology.
How often do the sand dance and the Sangomas, Divine, and the other healers do the ayahuasca? How often do they do this practice? It's not daily, is it?
Well, the ayahuascaers, you know, may do it every night, depending on the demand with patients and so on. They do it for healing and I guess it depends on the private practice. The San and the Sangomas will tend to do it when a certain critical level develops in terms of their energy body. This is how the bones, I think, develop because, you know, for a Sangoma to trance and to at least to get possessed is a lot of work. You have to have a lot of people drumming. You know, he or she has to dance. It requires quite a huge effort, just like the San trance dance requires a big effort. So the San, because of the environment, would probably do it more frequently when they're out of balance after a big hunt. If you go and visit them and, you know, some important people are there, like a bunch of tourists, they might do it. So there's no way of predicting. It's almost like the energy starts to build up and then suddenly there'll be the need for the dance and it'll just happen. Mm.
That would make sense that they would intuit the need, they would feel it, and then
exactly.
And then go for it.
Exactly.
The bones are interesting, too, in terms of, you know, hunter-gatherers make such good use of the handy things around them. Mm. So bones having different shapes and all of that, different sizes. It would be so similar to the I Ching set of coins, or I have a friend that used the Yarrow sticks, or making tarot cards or whatever. I mean, so many different divination systems. I don't think the imagery, the symbols, the various tools are so important as the system in setting up that language with whatever it is the mystery that you're communicating with.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, but what's fascinating about the South African model is that the bones have power because they're lion bones and crocodile bones and baboon bones.
They're
and
closer
wild
to the
pig
actual
bones
animals.
And, you know, they're all different animals and different parts of the animal which have different polarities. So, you know, for instance, the baboon bone might be the bone that represents the sorcerer, the you know, the witch. It has energy. I mean, you can feel it, you know, because of this long legacy of the animal. The hyena is the thief that comes in the night. So, for instance, if you're trying to find a lost object or you think somebody may have stolen something from you, then the hyena bone would feature very prominently. So it's not just arbitrary. There's an energy that relates to that particular animal's personality, much in the way that maybe a Native American might look to the character of a certain animal to want to adopt that, you know, that personality.
Oh, I'm glad you pointed that out, that the bones are even more direct to that, those spirits.
Yeah.
Wow. What do you suggest for those of us listening to your adventures, your insights? How can we apply these into our own life?
Well, it's simple but difficult. I think the one thing is to have a spiritual practice that's fun and that's, you know, friendly to you, that you can do on a regular basis, hopefully at least three times a week, where one can try and escape into that primal realm, doesn't matter what you call it, you know, the meditative state. To me, what value I got from the wilderness experience, what I called wilderness rapture, was the kind of ecstatic states you can get into if you go out into the wilderness for long enough. You can experience, you know, by, say, doing yoga. So one doesn't have to, you know, necessarily go out and spend 2 weeks in the Andes to get into that state. So I think some kind of useful, usable spiritual practice is absolutely key. And unfortunately for most of us, including myself, it's stress-busting most of the time.
You have to bust through the layer of stress in order to get to that space, you mean?
What I mean is that I'd like to get deeper and deeper and deeper, and sometimes I can if I'm on a month retreat, but mostly when I go from work to yoga, I'm just basically bringing myself hopefully back to a reasonable norm, and I'm not going deeper than that. But unless we do that, at least, you know, we need to at least get back to we have to reset our thermostat. And then the other thing I think is just this idea of the balance of polarity, which pertains to the practice, is that it's always a question of balancing the different opposites. And it's not just a question of only, for instance, going to alternative healing. One also has to have the technology. It's a combination of high sophistication, which we need and we want, and it's pretty amazing, together with the primal. You know, it's ancient wisdom, but it's also technology. It's masculine and it's feminine. It's always this yin-yang balance thing, and it's a trick. I mean, you have to really work at it quite hard. And I think the other thing that I would say is that it's just a sense of adventure. Is to, if you think of doing something, do it. You know, not to just follow the dream. You know, to get out there and see that you'll navigate with your soul, so that your soul has a chance to express itself in different ways and learn from different aspects. The one wonderful thing about wilderness and travel is it puts you in a different paradigm. It will shock you out of your habituated way of thinking, and that's very useful.
You bet. I am so saddened by the loss of the wisdom traditions that is going on as these various cultures, especially the small tribes around the world, have fewer and fewer members, have more westernized, I don't know, western engulfing them, as the children don't want to learn the techniques of the elders. What can be done? You've thought about this, obviously.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's anything that can be done, you know, because what's really happening is that in South Africa, for instance, or even with the Bushmen, one sees we are in a way responsible, not that we could do anything about it, but each time I go, say, and visit the Bushmen, the Bushmen are impacted by the presence of somebody who has things, you know. And when somebody has things and you don't have things, the next step that you want is that you want to get those things. So although the old people within their wisdom know that it's not important, the young people haven't sorted that out yet. And look how long it took us to sort it out. You know, uh-huh. To find out that the American dream isn't really all that it's cracked up to be. You know, the dream might be getting away from the acquisitiveness. So it's hard for us to really... put it this way, I sympathize with their predicament, and for somebody who's been living in a suboptimal situation, the next step for them might be to own a car or a camera or something, and then later on they're going to have to get to the point where they can give it up, that kind of that strong ego thing you were talking about. Once you have built it up, then you give it away.
I don't know
if there's a solution.
In other words, you can't say, just remain in your nice pristine state because it's nice for me to know that you're there while I have all the goodies and you don't.
Exactly. You know, and I've had the opportunity to realize they're not important, whereas they haven't. You know.
Yeah.
And even we have trouble with knowing when they're important and when they're not. We don't like to give them up so easily.
Yeah. We tend to think they're our birthright, don't we?
Yeah. So. Yeah, you know, I don't know what the solution is, but I know that I think if they can be validated, if one of the quests I think I have is to try and validate the incredible wisdom Africa has to offer, because people just see, when they look at Africa, they just see another dictator, another despotic state, another bunch of statistics on AIDS. But that they don't see is this amazing wisdom that's been there for thousands of years that now people are talking about, you know, about third-era medicine and not being confined to the space-time continuum. But if you speak to Sangomas, they've been doing this for hundreds of years, you know. It's like
they're the experts there.
Yeah, they laugh at you. You know, and they say, well, what's new, you know? Wake up.
What do your Western colleagues think of your adventures?
You know, I don't advertise what I do. I think many of them think I'm kind of a bit strange and weird, but they relate to the fact that I do some exotic things, so they appreciate it. I don't tell them too much about the kind of things we've been talking about. I think some of them get to hear about it, and I don't know what they think about me, but I know that they're pretty conservative, and I don't really advertise it. The patients, though, are different. You know, many of the physicians are still very conservative and quite threatened by the whole idea.
What was it in you, David, that allowed you to break through the cultural mindset and go seeking these answers to your questions?
Yeah, you know, I think what happened is it was just a dissatisfaction in my life, probably brought about by the fact that medicine didn't turn out to be all it was cracked up to be. And I ended up in a private practice, which wasn't, you know, the fulfilling like academic medicine had been for me. I couldn't hide under my title of MD anymore, you know, and I had to sort of start looking at who I really was.
Oh, the wounded healer.
Yeah, exactly.
You talk about that in your book.
So, you know, I think it was a wake-up call that came out of a dissatisfaction with, you know, my life, and made me look at the fact that although I thought I was very accomplished, when I started to hang out with other people who did yoga, who may not have had my opportunity and may not have had the MD degree, they were far more complete and whole than I was, and they'd really experienced a lot more about life than I had. And I was the poorer for it, you know, and I thought, gosh, you know, here I am. I think that I've got it all, and I got much less than, you know, a lot of these people have been far less fortunate than me.
So we seek to become whole, a whole person.
Yeah.
And fill in the blanks.
Right.
Where do you go from here?
Well, it seems like I'm spending more and more time in Africa, and I think, you know, your point about the indigenous knowledge systems, I'm trying to learn as much as I possibly can about them and help support them and validate them in the context of Africa. Like we both alluded to, I always wanted to do an alternative form of healing, and only recently I've found that I had to go back to my roots to find the one I wanted to do the most.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing about it is I didn't choose it chose me. I mean, I would go to Sangoma and they would tell me that I have to do this.
Interesting.
Which was kind of interesting. I didn't choose it. And then after the sixth time of having the bones read for me and being told I have to do this, I eventually decided, well, I better do it. So I think that's where I'm heading, is to try and integrate, you know, the indigenous and the Western, looking at it from both points of view, and hopefully being able to span the bridge a bit better because of my medical background.
We need more liaisons like that, don't we?
Yeah, I think so.
How long was your apprenticeship to read these bones?
Well, I had to go back and forth, you know, over a period of 3 years. So, you know, I'm still learning, but I know I've been given clearance now to practice, and the bones, as I say, speak, and the dreams talk, and I now have a sort of a basic pharmacopoeia of spirit medicines to work with, but, you know, I'm like an intern, you know.
Do your patients request that here in Santa Barbara? Do they come and say?
Sometimes they do, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes when they get to know more about me. Yeah.
Thank you so much, David. Any last thoughts that you want to leave us with this evening?
No, not really. I think you've really been very, very thorough in, you know, exploiting all of the few things I have to tell you.
We've had a good visit, I'll say that.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate what you've done in your life, and to take it back and really give medicine the full... I mean, you talked about the balance, the male, the female, the balancing, the... This is what Western medicine needs to do. Go back to its roots, its very deep indigenous roots that span hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah.
many, many lifetimes, and also the technology. And then Western medicine will be, medicine in general will have even more tools in its toolbox to use. We'll truly understand closer what the healing process is all about and our own participation in it. So thank you so much.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck in Africa. We want to join you in one of these days.
Okay,
your trips.
We'll stay in touch.
That was David Cumes. His books include, what's your first title?
Inner Passages, Outer Journeys.
And his latest, The Spirit of Healing. Thank you so much, and thank you for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.